This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Alex Ritson, and at 13 hours GMT on Tuesday, the 1st of July, these are our main stories. Thailand's Prime Minister Pettong Tan Shinawat has been suspended by the Constitutional Court over disparaging comments she made in a leaked phone conversation. Police in Turkey have arrested more than 100 people in the city of Izmir in what critics say is another crackdown on the main opposition party. Also in this podcast...
I woke up at 3 a.m. to go and watch the game. And it was worth every minute of it.
How Saudi Arabia's Al Hilal caused a stunning upset in the FIFA Club World Cup. We begin this podcast in Thailand, where major political upheaval appears to be a regular occurrence. Last year, the country's prime minister was dismissed. The Constitutional Court has acted again today by suspending his successor, Pettong Tan Shinawat, who's under investigation following her handling of the country's border dispute with Cambodia. She is from the Shinawat dynasty. Her father is a former prime minister, and the pro-military, pro-royalist elite consider the powerful family a threat to the kingdom's traditional social order. I heard more from Shaima Khalil.
The court essentially voted on two things. One is to accept a petition that was put forward by 36 senators asking for her to be suspended after they said that she violated an ethical code, but also asked the court to investigate a leaked phone conversation between Pettong Tan Shinawat and the former Cambodian leader Hun Sen. The court voted unanimously to accept this case and to accept the petition, but also voted with a majority of 7-2 to suspend her. She now has 15 days to present her defense to the court, but the actual ruling of the court could last months.
This was a private phone call. She was the prime minister. Why was this so controversial?
Well, this private phone call was actually leaked by Hun Sen himself, and it was controversial because of the tone of it, because it further eroded trust in her leadership. This call was leaked between Pettong Tan and Mr. Hun Sen, in which she called him uncle. She was disparaging and dismissive to an army general. And so those who have gathered in the streets only a few days ago, thousands of them from the opposition, said that it was such a deferential tone that it just showed that it was a leader that couldn't be trusted with leading the country, especially that this was happening amidst an ongoing festering feud between the two neighbors over a border. And so it was a very sensitive time as well in the way that she handled it. She said that she apologized for it, and it was quite telling that she apologized surrounded by army generals at the time, but she said that this was a negotiating tactic.
Yeah, you say she was surrounded by army generals. Thailand has long had this tussle between the democratically elected politicians and the military. Is this a continuation of that?
The army so far has called for unity. We haven't seen any moves by the army, if you will. So far, it's been kept at on a political level. She actually stands a slim majority now in parliament because one key coalition party withdrew after this happened, after the call was leaked. So already she stood on very shaky ground when it came to her majority and her party's majority in parliament. But now she's been suspended. She actually reacted to that suspension by the Constitutional Court, saying, "I accept the court's deliberation. I'm not certain for how long the suspension is going to last, but I have 15 days to explain." And then she further apologized, again, quote, I'm just looking at it, to every Thai who was uncomfortable or upset with this issue. If she is dismissed, that will make her the second prime minister to be dismissed from that same party in the last 2 years.
Shaima Khalil in Tokyo. The Israeli ambassador to the United Nations has attacked critics of the controversial food distribution system set up in Gaza as an alternative to United Nations supplies. Danny Danon accused the UN of backing a deliberate Hamas-led campaign of disinformation about the Israeli and US-backed Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, or GHF. He made the comment after a UN meeting to discuss the plight of Palestinian civilians.
The UN is putting politics over humanitarian work. Many in the UN are actively spreading disinformation promoted by Hamas-controlled sources, defaming the GHF's work and providing cover for further attacks. This is our campaign, an organized, orchestrated campaign.
Earlier, some of the world's biggest aid agencies described the GHF as a deadly military-run program. The UN says more than 400 Palestinians have been killed while seeking aid from the foundation. This pregnant woman in Gaza sent us a voice message giving us a sense of the fear and disruption facing many Palestinian civilians.
I'm originally from Jabalia, north of Gaza. I'm pregnant and I was displaced to Bethlehem. In Bethlehem, we suffered a lot. We faced explosions, immense fear and hunger. The situation was extremely difficult. Then the Israeli army forced us out of Bethlehem to western Gaza. And while fleeing, I suffered terribly as I had to walk the whole way because there were no cars. There, Israeli tanks were terrorizing us, firing at people and causing a lot of dust. I feared I might lose the baby. When the Israelis surrounded Bethlehem, they ordered us to leave through the quadcopter drones. It was terrifying.
Our correspondent in Jerusalem, Wira Davis, explained the row over the GHF, starting with those comments by Israel's ambassador at the UN.
This is Danny Danon, of course, and he's saying basically this new American-backed operation hasn't been given a chance to succeed because his argument is that the UN and the 100 or so other agencies who previously operated in Gaza haven't given it a chance to succeed. Of course, that's a matter of opinion, but I think the evidence from the ground is that, you know, hundreds of people have been killed, according to various sources, in the month since the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation began its operations in and around these distribution centres. We've heard evidence from an Israeli newspaper who's spoken to Israeli army officers and enlisted soldiers who say they've been ordered to fire at or near large crowds of people near these distribution sites, even when there was no threat. I think from the point of view of the aid agencies, they say that because GHF only has four distribution centres, mainly in southern Gaza, it's impractical, it's chaotic, it forces tens of thousands of people to travel long distances to get aid. Whereas the previous UN, World Food Programme, World Health Organization system delivered aid to about 400 sites across Gaza. So it got aid to the people who needed it most. And what the aid agencies are saying is that that old system, which they want to see reintroduced, if you like, was the most effective way of getting aid to people in Gaza.
Yeah, the Israelis, they would probably see the United Nations, where this row has been playing out, as not being entirely impartial in this.
Well, look, the Israelis and the UN clearly haven't been getting on. You know, Israel has accused one UN agency, UNRWA, which is the United Nations Agency for Palestinian Refugees, of being complicit in the October the 7th attacks. But out of a, you know, out of a workforce of several thousand, only a handful of UNRWA employees were, there was evidence against them, and they were sacked by UNRWA. UNRWA still says it has a really important job to do in Gaza, even though it is stopped from operating by the Israelis where they can. But there are other UN agencies who do a valuable job. And of course, when we did have a previous ceasefire back at the start of the year, a lot of aid did get in through the normal UN channels to the people who needed it. You know, that's not to pretend there isn't still a crisis in Gaza. But of course, what Danny Danon, the Israeli ambassador to the UN, is saying, and what the Israeli government and the Americans are saying, is that they can deliver aid and they can bypass Hamas, which they accuse of stealing and appropriating aid for their own purposes.
Wira Davis in Jerusalem. And as we record this podcast, Israeli planes and tanks have continued to attack areas of North and South Gaza, reportedly destroying homes and prompting thousands of residents to flee. Now to Turkey, where police in the city of Izmir have arrested more than 100 local government officials from the opposition CHP party. Izmir, located on the Aegean coast, is the third largest city in Turkey and is seen as a bastion of opponents to President Recep Tayyip Erdogan. The officials have been arrested on charges of corruption. Emrah Temel from BBC Turkish gave me more details.
That was a very important operation because Izmir has been run by the main opposition Republican People's Party over two decades, and it has been a stronghold for the opposition. We haven't seen the indictment, but 157 arrest warrants were issued on corruption charges. Turkish media reported that these charges were linked to tender bidding. More than 120 people were arrested, and Izmir's former mayor, Tunç Soyer, was arrested as well. Main opposition party CHP denies accusations of corruption. Murat Bakan, an MP from the party in Izmir, said members were facing a similar crackdown to what happened in Istanbul earlier this year. And he also argued that it appeared that a judicial system acting on instructions were behind this. Turkish government denies these claims, saying the judiciary and courts are independent.
Yeah, you mentioned the events in Istanbul. That was where the city's mayor, Ekrem İmamoğlu, the main rival to President Erdogan, befell a similar fate.
Yes. A similar operation in opposition-run Istanbul in March saw the arrest of city's mayor, Ekrem İmamoğlu. He was removed from the office, jailed pending trial on corruption charges, and his political future actually has been thrown into jeopardy because his university diploma was revoked. Having a college degree is compulsory to be able to be a presidential candidate in Turkey, and he's been jailed. Indictment has not been released, and we still don't know what's going to happen to his political future.
Briefly, while we have you, clashes in Istanbul outside the offices of a satirical magazine.
Yes, four people from the prominent satirical magazine Leman, which can be dubbed as Turkey's Charlie Hebdo, were detained for publishing what the authorities say is a cartoon of Prophet Muhammad. The magazine denied this. Cartoonists and the editor were detained as well. Authorities announced that the issue would be recalled and banned.
Emre Temel from BBC Turkish. In the biggest shock so far of the FIFA Club World Cup, the Saudi Pro League side Al Hilal have knocked out the defending champions, Manchester City, of the English Premier League. Tuesday's match was a 7-goal thriller that went to extra time in Orlando, Florida. Al Hilal are now through to the quarterfinals, where they will play the Brazilian side Fluminense, who caused their own upset by beating the Italian giants Inter Milan 2-0. The Riyadh-based football journalist Wael Jabir told us what the win meant to Saudi fans.
It means a lot for Saudi football. The game kicked off at 4 a.m. local time, and anyone who's been to Riyadh knows this is a city that comes alive at night, but even more so today, despite it being a Tuesday morning. All the coffee shops in the central areas of Riyadh were packed with fans. Everyone either stayed up all night or woke up very early. Myself, I woke up at 3 a.m. to go and watch the game, and it was worth every minute of it. It was dramatic. Al Hilal were 1-0 down, then they went 2-1 up at the start of the second half. 90 minutes ended 2-2, and then it went into extra time. And finally, a 4-3 victory. Huge moment for not just for Al Hilal, but I think for all of Saudi football.
And did anyone expect Al Hilal to make it this far, to make it to the quarterfinals?
I think there was definitely quite a lot of optimism before the tournament. Al Hilal have in the previous format of the Club World Cup, they've reached the final. So they have quite a pedigree in this type of competition. However, with the draw, obviously first facing Real Madrid in the group stage, and now Manchester City in the round of 16, it was not an easy one. And to add to that as well, Al Hilal had to do without their best player, club captain, Saudi Arabia captain Salem Al-Dosari, who's arguably one of the best players in the Saudi Pro League, who got injured before just a couple of days before the Manchester City game. So going into that game, I was personally slightly optimistic before the injury news, but after that I thought, no, there's no chance against Man City. But I'm glad to have been proven wrong. I think, after the confidence from the draw against Real Madrid and now from the win against Man City, I think they'll be in a positive mood going into the Fluminense game.
Saudi football journalist Wael Jabir. He was talking to Rebecca Adams of BBC Sport. Still to come in this podcast. Can robots play football better than us? A man has been arrested in Denmark on allegations of spying for Iran. A German court issued an arrest warrant for the Danish national. Your regional editor, Danny Eberhardt, has more.
German prosecutors have named the suspect as Ali S., using the first initial of his surname, as is customary. They expect him to be extradited from Denmark. The authorities allege he was employed by Iranian intelligence to gather information about Jewish locations and certain Jewish individuals in Berlin. He's said to have conducted surveillance at three properties in the German capital last month. Prosecutors haven't named these, but local media report that one of them was the headquarters of the German-Israeli Society. The authorities believe the alleged surveillance was to prepare for further intelligence operations, possibly including attacks against Jewish targets. Germany is a strong backer of Israel. Chancellor Friedrich Merz recently said there was no reason to criticise Israel or the US over their attacks last month on Iranian nuclear facilities. He also warned of the risk of Iran targeting Israeli or Jewish targets in Germany. Iran's foreign ministry has been approached for comment on the spying allegations.
Danny Eberhardt. As we record this podcast, the US Senate is still holding a marathon vote on President Trump's huge budget bill, but the spending plan hangs in the balance after weeks of fraught negotiations. Republicans, who control both chambers of Congress, are split over how much to cut welfare programs in order to allow record tax breaks in the One Big Beautiful Bill Act. Meanwhile, Donald Trump's former close aide, Elon Musk, has again attacked the legislation, which the president once passed by the 4th of July. Eric Schmidt is a Republican senator from Missouri who backs the bill.
American people's with us. They want tax relief. They want border security. They want to make sure that we're deporting illegal immigrants. They want our military to be strong. And that's what this bill does. So Democrats can make up stuff along the way, which is what they're going to be doing. But ultimately, we're going to deliver for the American people.
Democrat Senator Mark Kelly outlined the reasons for his party's opposition to the bill.
So we'll be here as long as it takes for us to show the American people that this is bad policy. This is going to kick 17 million people off of their health care to give a big, giant tax cut to the wealthiest Americans. We're literally going to take money from people that don't have it, that's used to pay a doctor or a hospital when they're sick, and that money is going to be transferred to the richest people in our country. And that's wrong.
Republicans are divided. Two have already voted against the bill, and the Democrats need two more defectors in order to block it. Our correspondent in Washington, Jake Kwon, has this update.
And certainly the Democrats are trying to make the Republicans tire them out as much as possible, make it as painful as possible for them by first making them read out nearly 1,000 pages of this bill, which took more than 16 hours, and then debated them for 10 hours. Now they're making them, you know, vote on each amendment, which would, of course, take hours and hours. We don't know when this thing will end. So essentially, this bill, it keeps President Trump's broad tax cuts. And then at the same time, it increases the spending to enact some of his domestic policies, mainly the immigration. So it will strengthen the border security. It will strengthen his immigration enforcement people. So it's going to add, it's estimated, $3.3 trillion to America's national debt. And at the same time, in order to cut back on some of that deficit, it cuts back on the welfare programs like the food assistance program, as well as the health insurance for the low-income people. And this is why some of the people in the Republican Party had their doubts about this bill. But what we saw is President Trump posting on social media over there, and he made this claim about 68% tax will rise if this bill does not pass. Now, I just need to point out that claim, we do not know where that number is coming from. It has not been very clear. And the independent review of this bill says that the increase in tax will be somewhere on the single-digit number. Now, President Trump is chastising any holdouts to pass this bill. It is a very slim margin. And we just saw that Elon Musk not only threatened to start his own party, but he will back any politicians to run against the Republican members who will be voting for this bill come the midterms election next year. So the Republican lawmakers who are in the chamber right now are really stuck between a rock and a hard place. On one side, you have the world's richest man who is threatening to fund your opponents next year. And on the other side is, of course, President Trump, who still has very powerful power within the party.
Jake Kwon in Washington. And let's stay in the U.S., where the Secretary of State Marco Rubio announced in March that the Trump administration was cancelling over 80% of programs at the U.S. Agency for International Development, USAID. There were warnings that the funding cuts would have dire consequences for some of the world's most vulnerable people. Now, a new study in the Lancet journal has put a figure on those affected. It says more than 14 million people worldwide could die in the next 5 years because of the Trump administration's dismantling of US foreign aid. From today, the organization will be officially absorbed into the US State Department. Davide Rasella is one of the co-authors of the research and takes us through the findings.
We evaluated the impact of USAID funding during the last two decades, and we estimated that the interventions funded by USAID have been able to prevent more than 91 million deaths in the last two decades. For example, we have evaluated that USAID funding was able to prevent more than 25 million of deaths due to HIV/AIDS. More than 11 million deaths due to diarrheal diseases, more of it 8 million deaths due to lower respiratory infections, and malaria, other 8 million, almost 9 million of deaths due to neglected tropical diseases. So they are the majority infectious diseases and diseases and conditions due to poverty. And using these estimates and effectiveness parameters, we have projected scenarios for the future. And we have compared a scenario where we have estimated how much a dismantling of the agency will cause in terms of deaths. And we came up with this number, more than 14 million deaths. USAID is intervening and is supporting healthcare and health-related intervention, but also a lot of intervention related to nutrition, food safety, education, water and sanitation, and all this have an important effect on health. Now they are called the social determinants of health. They are particularly important in extremely vulnerable populations. And that's why we came up with these large numbers, because we don't just consider single health-related interventions, but we want to show the broader picture.
Davide Rasella. The kings and queens of Denmark and Sweden have met on the Øresund Bridge exactly 25 years after it first opened. The 8-kilometre road and rail link connects the Danish capital Copenhagen with the Swedish city of Malmö. It is the longest bridge of its kind in the EU, and while it's boosted business and cross-border life in the region, it hasn't been without its challenges, as the BBC's Maddie Savage reports.
Central Copenhagen is a blend of 17th century brightly coloured townhouses and edgy bars and fashion boutiques. But I'm here to visit IO Interactive, a Danish gaming company. It's known for creating the globally popular Hitman franchise and is currently working on a new James Bond game.
I don't think we've had the pleasure. Something I've been doing a lot recently is looking at the reaction videos of our launch trailer.
That's Sandra Mondal, who lives in Malmö, Sweden's third largest city, but commutes over the Øresund Bridge to the company's headquarters in Copenhagen several times a month.
It takes me about an hour door to door because of the infrastructure with the bridge and the trains, and it's super easy.
Driving across can take less than 15 minutes. It's around 10 miles long, including a tunnel section.
I find it magnificent.
Let me tell you a bit more about the bridge's history as I make my way over to the other side in Malmö. It opened at the turn of the millennium, costing more than $4 billion at the time, with the goal of increasing travel, trade and networking in the region. New figures released by Øresunds Instituted, an independent research organisation, suggest cross-border commuting has increased by more than 400% since then. And there's been a big jump in the number of Danes and Swedes starting businesses on either side of the water. A short walk from the train station is Malmö University's Urban Studies Department, where Helena Bormann is an associate professor.
Once you open up the connection, companies can share input markets, customer markets. Finding specialised skilled staff is easier.
Malmö has experienced a surge in new tech startups and life science companies. and more than 100 businesses have moved headquarters or specialist offices here to benefit from the region's infrastructure.
But I also think for people living in one side of the border and working on the other side, there's a lot of administration involved, you know, taxes, not having to pay double taxes and so on.
Another challenge is punctuality. Helena says major disruptions linked to border controls and reduced services during the pandemic eroded trust amongst some commuters. But a recent study by Swedish public service broadcaster SVT suggests around 90% of commuter trains are now punctual and record numbers of people are using them.
The current challenge is that travelling by train between Denmark and Sweden is a success, so the trains is crowded.
That's Johan Westman, CEO of the Öresunds Institute at research organisation. He says a new generation of faster trains with larger capacities are on the way, though.
But it will be established about in 5, 6, 7 years in the future. So until then, you still will have crowded trains.
Despite facing challenges, the Öresund Bridge remains a European icon for cross-border collaboration. And Swedish and Danish authorities are discussing boosting this even further with new fixed connections, including a road and rail tunnel and even a subway between the two Nordic countries.
Maddie Savage. Now, we'd probably like to think that sports in general and football in particular is one area where we humans can still outperform AI-driven computers and robots. Or can we? China is putting that to the test, hosting the first AI robot football match. Our reporter Alfie Habershon tuned in to assess the talent on display.
The beautiful game definitely has felt a bit robotic in recent times. The obsessive tactics, brutal fitness regimes, the endless graphs and data. It's easy to see why our humanoid friends might be a good fit. So I was curious when 6 spindly figures with silver arms and legs gathered around the centre circle for kickoff in Beijing. The result, a little less sci-fi horror, a little more robot freak show. Flailing metal legs appeared to entirely miss contact with the ball, which rolled off to the side, as 4 of the humanoids then became stuck together in a confused state of head rubbing. The other 2 did make a very slow dash for it, but then... a loss of balance and a backwards stagger left one collapsed on the floor, and the other then dropped beside it in a metal heap, as humans rushed onto the pitch with stretchers. Lionel Messi, Cristiano Ronaldo, Kylian Mbappe, for now, your jobs are more than safe.
Alfie Habershon. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at BBC World Service. Use the hashtag Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Alison Purcell Davis, and the producers were Carla Conti and Muzaffar Shakir. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Alex Ritson. Until next time, goodbye.